drunk a few hours later. I always thought, that's not going to be me. But a few months later, guys sat on the same roof and watched me come back stumbling drunk. Believe me, it was easy to find a drink in Khan Thai if you wanted one. Of course, you had to be careful where you went because the Viet Cong also used Khan Thai as an R&R spot. Charlie would dress like a Vietnamese peasant and walk right into town for some rest and relaxation. Most of the watering holes were filled with bar girls, some of whom made so much money from American troops that they bought estates in the countryside. You could find a drink and a girl whenever you wanted for the right price. It was the only time in my life when I drank heavily. Now, I partied during my short stay at Louisiana Tech, but it was different in Vietnam. I was largely drinking to forget where I was. When you're in a place like Vietnam, you get to a point where you don't care anymore. You're in a place that's foreign to you, and you know for a fact that many people there hate you and will kill you if they get the chance. It really does something to your mind to know that many of the people living around you don't like you and want you to die. Believe it or not, I came close to killing two people in Vietnam. Shortly after I arrived there, I was on guard duty in a tower at the airfield. I had an M14 rifle and a slingshot. Guess what Vietnamese children like to do for fun? They like to throw rocks at the American guards and the watchtowers. I kept a handful of rocks in one of my ammunition pouches just in case I became a target. One day, while I was on guard duty, a rock nailed me on the side of my head. I touched my hair and my hand was covered in blood. I thought I'd been shot. I looked down and saw a Vietnamese boy laughing and pointing at me. I clicked my gun and started to aim to shoot him. Thankfully, I came to my senses and didn't do it. The next time I was hit by a rock, I returned fire with my slingshot. Before too long, I was having regular slingshot wars with the Vietnamese children around our airfield. It didn't take them long to figure out that I was a better shot than them. The other time I nearly took a life, I was waiting for a truck to pick me up and felt a tap on my kidney. I turned around and saw a huge snake staring right at me. A Vietnamese woman, we called them Mama Sons, had a boa constrictor wrapped around her neck. It was big enough to eat her if it wanted. "You want to buy the snake?" she asked me. I grabbed my gun and was fixing to shoot her and the snake. I'm not sure if I could have ever shot Charlie if I had to, but I was ready to shoot her. Here's how bad it got for me during my 12 months in Vietnam. A buddy and me came up with the brilliant idea of us volunteering to be door gunners in helicopters. At the time, the life expectancy of a door gunner in Vietnam was about 3 days. When one was killed, the army put another soldier in his place. It was about the most dangerous job in the war, and my buddy and I were getting ready to volunteer for it. Fortunately, I came to my senses before we signed up. I must have been insane to even be thinking about it. I drank so much beer and whiskey in Vietnam that I decided I would quit drinking alcohol altogether once I returned home. I saw what alcohol was doing to me in Vietnam and realized I needed to stop for good. But I had to make it home alive for that to happen.
I don't like uniforms. Hey, right now, I want to kick my own butt.
Chapter 15, Deuce and a Half. Shortly after I arrived in Vietnam, some of the soldiers who had been there for a while gave me a few tips on how to survive. One of the most important things they told me was to make sure all of my personal belongings were locked down at all times, because the Vietnamese loved to steal from Americans. Now, Mama and Daddy had taught me that stealing was a sin. Thou shalt not steal is one of the Ten Commandments. So I found it hard to believe that the nice Vietnamese people would steal from the very people who were sent there to protect them. "What are you talking about?" I asked one of the soldiers. "These people will steal anything and everything," he said. "Hey, I don't believe you," I said. "Give me an example." "These people will steal your radio and leave the music," he said. "Now that's a thief," I told him. It didn't take me long to figure out he was telling the truth. One of my daily duties in Vietnam was to drive troops from our hotel to the Khan Thai airfield in the morning and then back to the hotel at the end of the workday. I transported the troops in a 2.5-ton cargo truck. We called it a deuce and a half. And it didn't have a canvas over the bed or rails on its sides. The Army started using the M-35 family of trucks in 1949 and utilized them all the way through Operation Iraqi Freedom. Obviously, they were good, dependable trucks. The truck had a 10-tire configuration so it could carry as much as 20,000 pounds of cargo on the road. It was a very versatile truck in a war zone. One day, before I made the drive back to the hotel, which was only about 1 mile, I walked around my truck and gave it a thorough inspection. I was required to inspect the truck every time I climbed behind the steering wheel to make sure it was working properly and hadn't been booby-trapped by the Viet Cong. I saw that each of the 10 tires was there and was inflated properly and didn't notice anything else suspicious. After I gave a thumbs up, the troops loaded up in the bed of the truck and I pulled out to drive back to the hotel. But on this particular day, for whatever reason, there was a lot of traffic in downtown Khon Ta, so the drive took a little longer than usual. Even though the traffic was crazy, I never had to completely stop and probably didn't drive less than 10 miles per hour. I arrived at the hotel and the troops started to unload. I locked up the steering wheel, locked the doors, and then started to walk to the hotel. "Hey, Robertson," one of the soldiers yelled to me. "You're missing a tire." "Yeah, sure," I said. "No, seriously, you're missing a tire off the back," he said. "Good grief," I said, knowing the soldier was probably trying to play a trick on me. I walked back to the truck and saw a lug nut sticking out of where one of the dual back tires used to be. Someone stole a tire while I was driving back to the hotel. "Y'all didn't see anything?" I asked a few of the soldiers who had gathered around the truck. "No," one of them said. "We didn't see anything. Hey, look, all of the tires were on this truck when we left the airfield," I said. "I never stopped. Y'all were sitting in the back. You didn't see anything?" "Nope," one of them said. "Something's not right with this picture," I said. "You're sitting above the tires, you idiots. You have to have seen or heard something." "No, we didn't hear or see anything," one of them said. I sat there looking at the lug nut while scratching my head and trying to figure out what had just happened. "The lug nuts must have been loose," one of them said. "The tire must have fallen off." We didn't have loose lug nuts on a deuce and a half. When we put tires and lug nuts on a deuce and a half, we had to stand on the tire iron to make sure they were tight. There wasn't any way the lug nuts were loose. The only plausible explanation was that a Vietnamese person stole a tire while I was driving down the road. NASCAR pit crews don't work that fast, Jack. I know it might be hard to believe, but it's exactly what happened. Now, I've never had much patience for thieves. A thief is someone who is too lazy to work for what he wants, so he'll steal from someone else. I've read about smart thieves and not-so-smart thieves. In the Czech Republic last year, a band of thieves stole a 10-ton bridge. They arrived at a depot and informed the workers they'd been hired to disassemble the bridge to make way for a new one. The thieves walked away with millions of dollars in scrap metal before anyone figured out the bridge wasn't supposed to come down. Now that's a thief, Jack. Last year, a man snatched a woman's purse while she walked through a park in Georgia. When police located a man matching the suspect's description, they put him into a police cruiser and returned to the scene of the crime. Police told him to exit the vehicle and face the victim for an ID. He looked at her and said, "Yeah, that's the woman I robbed." Hey, at least he was honest. The Lord tells us we're supposed to love everyone, so I don't hate thieves. I guess there is even a place in heaven for them. At least I can respect their ingenuity, and they're still more likable than most of the attorneys I've met. One day, a teacher, a petty thief, and a lawyer died and went to heaven. St. Peter met them at the gates and said, "Sorry, heaven's about filled up, so you'll have to answer a question correctly to come in." St. Peter looked at the teacher and asked, "What's the name of the famous ocean liner that sank in the Atlantic Ocean after hitting an iceberg?"
"The Titanic," she said.
"Correct," St. Peter said. "Come on in." Then St. Peter turned to the thief. "How many people died on the ship?" he asked.
"Oh, that's a difficult question," the thief said. "But I saw the movie, and I think the answer is about 1,500.
"Close enough," St. Peter said. "Come on in."
Finally, St. Peter turned to the lawyer.
"Name each of the deceased," he said.
"Hey, let me tell you how bad the Vietnamese were about stealing. One of the Army's platoons had set up shop on a mountainside above a village in the Mekong Delta. They were on a reconnaissance mission going from village to village to determine whether Charlie had infiltrated them or not. For whatever reason, they kept burning up power generators and losing electricity at their base camp. They couldn't figure out what was happening. No matter what they did, they were burning up brand new generators every night. The motor officer was yanking his hair out trying to figure it out. Every night before they turned them on, they checked the oil and made sure they were operating correctly, but they kept burning up in the middle of the night. Finally, one of the officers decided he was going to get to the bottom of it. The generators usually ran on 220 volts, but you could convert them to 440 volts. One night, the officer shut down the generators and switched them to 440 volts. After he turned the generators back on, the village became extremely bright. It looked like the Las Vegas Strip. All of a sudden, it sounded like fireworks. TVs, radios, and all the other appliances in the village were blowing up. It looked like a firefight in the bush. The officer sent a few soldiers down the hillside, and they discovered a string of extension cords that probably covered 2 miles from the generators to the village. Every night, one of the Vietnamese villagers snuck up the hill and plugged the cord into the generators. The Vietnamese watched TV all night on Uncle Sam. Now that's a thief, Jack.
I'm like Aretha Franklin. I don't get any R-E-S-P-E-C-T around this joint.
Chapter 16. Guard Duty. One of my first jobs in Vietnam was working in a warehouse in the back of Con Tah Airfield. Every chance I had, I rode in a rough terrain forklift with the guy who was operating it. I rode with him for about 6 months to learn how to drive it. I figured if something happened to the guy who was driving it, I'd be next in line to jump into the driver's seat. Driving the forklift would keep me out of harm's way if nothing else. Hey, I might have been born at night, but it wasn't last night, Jack. Mostly, we loaded and unloaded supplies from cargo planes and moved crates to where they needed to be. But every now and then, we'd get in a Jeep, deuce and a half, or 5-ton cargo truck that had been shot up by the Viet Cong. Our job was to go over the vehicle and strip it down, taking every working part we could possibly use. We'd set aside tires, wheels, motors, batteries, transmissions, carburetors, water pumps, and any other parts we could salvage. Normally, only the metal frame of the Jeep or cargo truck was left. We'd pick up the truck or Jeep frame with the forklift and drop it into a pond at the back of the airfield. Well, as I suspected, the guy who was driving the forklift left Vietnam when his enlistment in the Army was over. A sergeant came up to me and said, "Hey, we need somebody to drive the forklift. Do you know how to do it?" "Hey, can you crank it?" I asked. "I've been watching you ride around with him for 6 months," the sergeant asked. "You never saw him crank it?"
"No, I never saw him do it," I said. "Do you want me to do everything around here?"
So the sergeant climbed into the forklift and cranked it up. "Get out of the way," I told him. From that day forward, my job was to drive the rough terrain forklift in the warehouse and motor pool at the airfield. Some nights, I also had to take my turn on guard duty at the airfield. I usually guarded the motor pool where they kept the Jeeps, trucks, and other vehicles we used in the Army. The motor pool extended all the way to the edge of the pond where we dumped the stripped truck and Jeep frames. One day, we had a brand new deuce-and-a-half diesel engine come to us in a metal box. New engines were like gold in Vietnam. Most of our vehicles were pretty outdated, so it was rare that we acquired new equipment. The technicians in the motor pool took the engine out of the box, hooked a battery to it, and cranked it to make sure it was running properly. Then they bolted it back down because they planned to put it in a deuce and a half the next morning. That night, a buddy and I were on guard duty. We had to cover a pretty big compound, so we started the night walking the fence in opposite directions. About an hour later, we hooked back up again for a cigarette break. "You see anything?" I asked him. "No, I didn't see anything," he said. "No, me neither," I said. Suddenly, we heard some noise coming from the motor pool area. I called the watchtower and told them to pop a flare over the motor pool. They fired a flare and it lit up the entire area. We scanned the motor pool and didn't see anything. We checked under and inside every vehicle to make sure Charlie wasn't hiding anywhere. We didn't find anything suspicious. I called the watchtower again and told them to shoot a flare over the pond. I wanted to make sure our suspects weren't swimming back across the pond, which separated the American Army compound from the South Vietnamese military base. When a flare lit up the sky again, I looked out at the pond and saw the brand new deuce and a half engine floating on the water. There was a Vietnamese person swimming on each side of it. The two men were swimming with one arm while holding the engine with the other. They were stroking their free arms kind of like the Olympians do in the butterfly stroke. Now you have to understand that this was a 478 cubic inch engine that probably weighed close to 1,650 pounds. I looked closer to see if the engine was floating on a raft, but didn't see one. I looked to see if the Vietnamese had magically built a bridge across the pond, but didn't see one. As my buddy and I watched the Vietnamese in amazement, they stroked the engine all the way across the pond. The pond was more than 100 yards wide. I'll never forget the expression on my buddy's face after the Vietnamese reached the other side of the pond. Neither one of us said anything, but he had the dumbest look on his face. Then he smiled. After I picked my jaw up off the ground, I asked him, "What did you see?" "You first," he said. "Let me start this conversation out this way," I said. "Did you see any kind of flotation device around that diesel engine?" "No," he said. "Are you sure you didn't see any kind of flotation device?" I asked him again. "Uh-uh," he said. "Well, how many people did you see?" I asked. "One on each side," he said. "Did you see any kind of raft?" I asked him. "Nope," he said. "Did you see any kind of bridge?" I asked. "Nope," he said. "Well, how are we going to report this in the morning?" I asked him. "I'd rather not report it," he said. "Hey, they're going to be missing that diesel engine in the morning, and then they're going to come looking for us," I said. "They're going to ask us why we weren't doing our jobs while we were on guard duty. We're going to have to report it. A brand new diesel engine just doesn't get up and walk away." "I don't know what we're going to say," he said. "All I know is we can tell the truth," I said. "Did you see one Vietnamese on both sides of the engine?" "Yep, that's what I saw," he said. "Well, that's what we're telling them," I said. "Sounds good to me," he said. I knew no one was going to believe us. When I gave my report to the officer in charge the next morning, he said, "Hey, y'all were smoking weed, weren't you?" "I don't smoke weed, sir," I told him. "Well, then you were drunk," he said. "Hey, on a bad day, you might have me on the alcohol use because I keep a fifth of liquor in my pocket," I said. "But I don't drink while I'm on guard duty." Well, after my buddy and I were interrogated for the next few hours, they finally believed our story, or at least they couldn't come up with another plausible explanation as to what happened to the engine. My commanding officer sent two MPs in a jeep to the other side of the pond. Much to their amazement, they found the deuce and a half engine inside the South Vietnamese military compound and brought it back to the American side. All these years later, I'm still not exactly sure how deep the water was in the pond. Day after day for 6 months, I watched Jeep and truck frames get dropped into the pond, so it was obviously pretty deep water. What I do know is the pond was deep enough for 50 Vietnamese soldiers to stand on each other's shoulders and carry a diesel engine for more than 100 yards. And boy, the Vietnamese sure can hold their breath.
A beaver is like a ninja. The circles only work at night, and they're hard to find.
Chapter 17. Leave It to Beavers. Hey, my hat is off to the Vietnamese. They're some of the most resourceful people I've ever seen. In a lot of ways, they were like beavers. They worked only at night, they were relentless, and they didn't stop working until the job was finished. Hey, it's hard to capture or kill something if it only moves at night. Beavers are hard to kill, and so were the Vietnamese. It's the reason the Vietnam War lasted so long. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong continued to fight us even though they were grossly outmanned. They didn't think they could lose, and they took advantage of their natural surroundings. Look, you know what's unbe-beaverable? In 2010, scientists discovered that beavers had constructed a dam of trees, branches, grasses, and mud in Alberta, Canada that was more than half a mile long. The dam is located in a remote part of Wood Buffalo National Park, and park rangers didn't even know it was there until scientists saw it on satellite images from outer space. Scientists say the dam is the largest in the world and that the beavers have probably been building it since the 1970s. Hey, you know how I feel about beavers. I believe they're the pelted plague. The furry rodents are nothing more than log-chewing, water-slapping, flat-tailed rascals. Phil and I always have problems with them on our hunting land. They're our buck-tooth arch-nemeses. Beavers like to dam up water, which prevents it from reaching the land around our duck blinds. Look, it's pretty simple. If there's no water, there's no ducks. So there are a few things that are more enjoyable to me than blowing up a beaver dam. It's like I tell Phil, hey, give them a kiss for me, the kiss of death. I didn't know why beavers have flat tails until I went to Vietnam. Shortly after I arrived there, one of the American soldiers warned me to never go into the jungle at night. Now, I wouldn't have been caught dead in the jungle even during daylight, but I was curious to know why I shouldn't go in there at night. Because elephants jump out of the trees at night, he said. Hey, now you know why beavers have flat tails. They go into the jungle at night, Jack. While I despise beavers, I also respect their work ethic and determination. Do you know how hard it is to build dams and lodges? A lodge is a hollow mound of sticks, stones, and mud, and beavers live and sleep inside of them. Beavers usually build them on the banks or islands of a stream or river. The entrance to the lodge is underwater, so beavers first build a dam across the river to prevent the entrance from freezing during the winter. Hey, when two beavers walk into the house, the first one always tells the other one, hey, shut the damn door. Beavers work together to build their dams and lodges, kind of like we do when we're building duck calls. It's a collective effort. With their long, sharp teeth, beavers chew through thick trees. Hey, beavers are even smart enough to make sure the trees always fall toward their dams. They drag tree limbs with their teeth and push logs to the dam with their noses. Beavers even roll large stones on the logs to keep them in place. Hey, you want to talk about some busy beavers? When the beavers are finished constructing a lodge, they cover the walls with mud to insulate them and keep out predators. Whether it's foxes, wolverines, snakes, bears, grizzly adams, coyotes, or Daniel Boone. If a predator manages to break its way into the lodge, the beavers are able to escape through a secret exit. See, when beavers first start building a lodge, they burrow a secret tunnel on the other side of the river, which leads back to their lodge underwater. Now, tell me beavers aren't smart. When I was in Vietnam, it was like we were fighting some really mean beavers. They were ferocious, Jack. One of the first things American troops did when they built a new camp in the Mekong Delta was bring in engineers and bulldozers to clear about 200 yards of bush for a firing zone. If the Viet Cong attacked them, they wanted a clear area to fire mortars, grenades, or whatever else they wanted to repel them. As soon as the firing zone was cleared, the Americans built bunkers around the perimeter, giving our troops shelter and protection in case we were attacked. Well, at one forward base, the American troops dug bunkers around the perimeter just before dark. When they awoke the next morning, they discovered the Vietnamese had dug a bunker in front of every bunker they'd made. Their bunkers were even finished with roofs, hot tubs, and satellite dishes. Our bunkers were only holes in the ground. I told you the Vietnamese were like beavers. They only worked at night. And hey, you want to talk about smart. One of the American military's main objectives during the Vietnam War was to blow up bridges along the Ho Chi Minh Trail to cut off the Viet Cong supply lines. The Ho Chi Minh Trail ran from North Vietnam to South Vietnam, snaking through neighboring Laos and Cambodia along the way. Our Air Force flew over the trail and bombed bridges, wiping nearly every one of them out. After a few months, the Americans realized the Viet Cong were still moving supplies along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were still getting materials to South Vietnam, even without the bridges. Well, a few high-ranking officers assembled a couple of special forces teams for a reconnaissance mission to find out how the Viet Cong were doing it. After a few weeks of hiding in the bush, the Americans saw a trail of truck lights coming. The trucks were barely visible coming down a mountain. When the trucks pulled up to a river, they just kept coming, even though the bridge had been wiped out. The trucks drove through the water and came out on the other side. Hey, the Viet Cong built a bridge about 3 feet underwater. The U.S. Air Force couldn't even see the underwater bridges to blow them up. And you want to talk about bold? One time, the Viet Cong dug a tunnel under an American headquarters in Vietnam and listened to our high-ranking officers giving commands. The Americans were preparing to sweep an area where there were more than 100,000 Viet Cong troops. But when American troops swept the area, there wasn't a soul in sight. Hey, the Viet Cong listened to our orders and got everybody out. When the Americans left, the Viet Cong moved back in. When I left South Vietnam in October 1969, there were two battalions of North Vietnamese Army troops working the area around Khon Thai. A gunship finally located one battalion moving across an opening, but there was still a second battalion on the loose, and we could never find them. Sometimes the North Vietnamese were right under our noses and we didn't even know it. In the Seven Mountains region of the Mekong Delta, American troops kept bombing a mountain to drive out Viet Cong forces. But every time the Americans sent in a recon patrol, they took heavy fire and had to retreat. So the Americans sent in more B-52 bombers, artillery fire, and rockets. They hammered the mountain day after day for a couple of weeks, but American troops kept taking fire when they tried to capture the mountain. After bombing it every day for 3 months, the Americans finally took the mountain. When American troops went inside a cave in the mountain, they found a 10-story hospital inside. There were operating rooms, recovery rooms, and offices for the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops that came through the area. There was an American airfield right around the corner from the mountain, but we never even knew the hospital was there. Good night. Hey, at least beavers slap the water with their tails to let us know they're there.
I don't know any redneck who's not into fun. That's their middle name, Red Fun Neck.
Chapter 18, Black Market. While I was in Vietnam, I became sort of a psychologist for several of the soldiers from Bravo Company who were the infantry and foot soldiers. They were some of the bravest soldiers in Vietnam and always seemed to be in the line of fire. Well, the Army liked to give the guys who'd been beating the bush for 11 months a couple of weeks to cool off before they shipped them back to the United States. I guess Uncle Sam figured there wasn't any better place to do it than my hotel room. There was always an empty bunk in my hotel room in Khon Thai, and a lot of the guys from 11th Bravo ended up staying in my room for a couple of weeks. Hey, while they were cleansing their minds and relaxing, they liked to tell a lot of their stories to me. My empty bunk became Dr. Phil's sofa. I listened to their stories with an inquiring mind, and a lot of guys liked to bounce their fears and problems off of me. You wouldn't believe some of the stories I heard. One guy showed up and stayed in my hotel room for 3 weeks. We became pretty good friends, and he told me about how the Viet Cong attacked their camp one night. He said 3 of their guys were badly hurt during the attack, and the medic immediately started treating their wounds. The medic attended to one guy, leaned him up against a tree, and then started patching up the next guy. Well, after the medic patched up the second guy's shoulder, he moved on to the third guy, who was shot in the leg. All of a sudden, they heard the second guy screaming. A tiger had attacked him and was dragging him back into the jungle. The medic and the 2 other guys started shooting at the tiger and scared it back into the bush. It was one of the most frightening stories I heard in Vietnam. Fortunately for me, I avoided most of the dangerous missions in Vietnam. But one day, my colonel came to me and closed my hotel room door. "This conversation never took place," he said. "Uh-oh," I thought to myself, "I'm in trouble now." The colonel reached into his pocket and handed me 3,000 piastres, which was Vietnamese money. "Go get me a Jeep engine," he said. "Say what?" I asked. "Why did you come to me? What do you expect me to do?" "You have the money," he said. "Go find me a Jeep engine." Hey, I didn't know what to do. I went and found one of the guys staying in my room. He'd been in Vietnam for more than 3 years and was always downtown. He spoke good Vietnamese, so I figured he knew a bunch of the locals and where to find a Jeep engine. "Hey, Kelly," I said, "look, I need to go get a Jeep engine. Can you help me?" "Sure, I know where to go," Kelly said. "No problem. When do you need it?" "Now," I said. "What are we going to drive?" Kelly asked. "Hey, I guess we'll take the deuce and a half," I said. "We're going to need somewhere to put the engine." "Meet me in the lobby in an hour," Kelly said. An hour later, I met Kelly in the lobby and we loaded up in the deuce and a half. We drove downtown and he told me to pull the truck into a narrow alley. "Hey, this truck won't fit into the alley," I said. "Sure it will," he said. "Pull the truck all the way to the end." Sure enough, the truck fit into the alley with only a couple of feet to spare on each side. When we reached the end, Kelly jumped out and disappeared for a few minutes. He came back with a short Vietnamese man. "Get out," Kelly told me. I jumped out of the truck. The Vietnamese man proceeded to blindfold Kelly and me. "Where are we going?" I asked. "You don't need to know," the Vietnamese man said. Over the next several minutes, we walked through a maze of alleys and doorways, and then they loaded us into a car. We drove around Khon Thai for about 30 minutes. I knew I was going to die when we stopped. When we finally stopped, I heard a door open. We walked into a building, and then someone took our blindfolds off. When I opened my eyes, the only thing I could see was hundreds of large green containers. Property of the U.S. Army was stamped on the side of every container. There were engines for Jeeps, helicopters, and trucks lined up against the wall for nearly 300 yards. It was like an auto parts store. They had whatever the Army needed because they'd stolen it from us. "We need a Jeep engine," Kelly said. "Give them the money, Robertson." "Hey, this ain't the deal," I said. "I want to see the Jeep engine on our truck." "You sure are a trusting soul. We don't even know where we are." "Just give them the money," he said. "The engine will be on the back of the truck when we get back. I've done this before." Against my better judgment, I handed the Vietnamese man the money, knowing I'd never see it or him again. and I knew there wouldn't be an engine on our truck either. Well, they blindfolded us again and drove us back to our truck. When I opened my eyes, I couldn't believe it when I saw a Jeep engine in the back of it. The Vietnamese man shook my hand and said, "Nice doing business with you. Hey, now I buy everything through the black market. Designer jeans, boots, high-definition TVs, toasters, kidneys, livers, and Swatch watches. It's the only way to do business." I'll never forget the time a Bravo Company soldier stayed in my room for a couple of weeks shortly before I was sent home. The only things the guy carried with him were an M16 rifle, ammunition, and a small rucksack that had pineapple grenades hanging from it. I was beginning to wonder how crazy the guy actually was. One night, the guy staying next to us, our rooms were only separated by thin partitions, got drunk and started getting rowdy. They were throwing beer cans and boots at us. The guy staying with me started to get really upset. He'd been chasing Charlie for nearly a year while trying to stay alive, and the last thing he wanted to deal with was a few drunks. Well, when a boot hit the mosquito net over the guy's bed, he nearly lost it. He went next door and told them to settle down. A few seconds later, the guys threw another boot at him. The guy staying with me reached under his bed, grabbed a pineapple grenade, and popped the pin. Then he threw it over the partition into the next room. Hey, I was lying against the wall to the other room. I grabbed my thin mattress and wrapped my body in it. I was expecting the grenade to explode and blow me into the next room. When the grenade landed in the next room, it sounded like something out of a cartoon. The three guys over there started scurrying for cover. I thought they were all going to die. Well, the guy in my room was standing in our door, laughing his butt off. I thought he was slap insane. He walked into the next room, grabbed the grenade, came back, and threw it at me. "Hey, it's a dud," he said. "They reacted the same way Charlie does when I throw one into their bunker. There's one big difference, though. The Viet Cong doesn't get to run. When I throw it into their bunker, I mow them down as they scurry out." I looked at him and said, "Man, you're about half a bubble off. You're not right." I'm telling you, Vietnam did something to your mind if you were over there too long. Another guy who stayed in my room had been in Vietnam since the war started. He was on his 6th tour of duty. He was going home for leave and coming back for a 7th tour. "Hey, man," I told him, "you've done your part for your country. You've done your share and 5 other guys' shares. You have a wife and 2 beautiful daughters. Go home and stay there. Good grief." "Hey, I'm going home for 30 days to enjoy my family," he said. "Then I'm coming back here and kill some more Viet Cong." "Man, you're not right," I said. "If my mind was a computer chip, I guess there might be a few blips on it," he said. "Hey, I guess I'm lucky. My brain was faulty before I even went to Vietnam."
As someone who travels with a gallon of tea, I've got to make a lot of pit stops.
Chapter 19, Iced Tea Glass. Believe it or not, we actually had pretty good food in the Army. There was one cook in Vietnam who baked some of the best cinnamon rolls you could ever want to put in your mouth. He loved to bake, and his cinnamon rolls were humongous. He didn't spare any of Uncle Sam's sugar or cinnamon either. His cinnamon rolls would melt in your mouth, and we actually cried when he went home. I worked in the kitchen for a few weeks during basic training at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. I had a crazy buddy I met on the train from Shreveport, Louisiana, and he told me he had the answer to all of our worries about being in the Army. "Hey, we volunteer for everything," he said. "Look," I said, "everybody I've talked to told me not to volunteer for nothing. People have warned me about doing something stupid like volunteering." During our first week of basic training, one of the sergeants walked up to my platoon and said, "I need 2 volunteers for KP. I knew KP was kitchen patrol, and I didn't want any part of it. But before I could even move, my buddy had not only his arm up, but also mine. "You idiot," I told him. "This better work out." Hey, it might have been worse. When I was in Vietnam, one of the sergeants asked my platoon if any of us had experience in radio communications. I nearly raised my hand because I thought I might finally get to see some serious action, but then I thought better of it. Some sucker from Indiana, who was an amateur radio operator, raised his hand instead. Good, the sergeant said. You can dig the hole for the new telephone pole. For 2 weeks during boot camp, I helped in the kitchen, mostly peeling potatoes and washing pots and pans. I received a behind-the-scenes look at how the food was prepared and cooked. Hey, it wasn't pretty. Surprisingly, we actually had good meat coming to the kitchen. The steaks we were fed were some of the best-looking beef I'd ever seen, at least until the cooks got their hands on them. What the army cooks did to the meat was criminal. Hey, you haven't chewed on a $2 steak until you've eaten a New York strip in the army. But the rest of the chow they cooked in the mess hall didn't taste that bad for the most part. After I was finished with KP, I made the mistake of offering our company cook some advice. Hey, if you put a lid on the pan, there will be less dust and dirt in your soup, I said. You mind your business, he told me. Your job is to defend South Vietnam. That's right, I told him. My duty is to defend South Vietnam, not eat it. Even some of the combat rations the Army fed us were pretty edible. Our rations were actually called meal, combat, individual, MCI, but everybody called them C rations, which was what the Army had been feeding its troops since the end of World War II. The MCI was introduced in 1958 and came to us in a cardboard carton, which contained one small flat can, one large can, and two even smaller cans. The cans were stacked on top of each other, so they were easy to carry in your pack. The M unit can was a meat-based entree, which might have been something like beefsteak with potatoes and gravy, beans and wieners, chicken and noodles, chopped ham and eggs, ham and lima beans, or spaghetti with meatballs. The spaghetti was probably my favorite. Crackers, chocolate, hardtack biscuits. Everybody called them John Wayne cookies. Processed cheese, peanut butter, or jam was usually in the B unit can, and the D unit can was a dessert, typically something like apricots, peaches, pears, fruit cocktail, pound cake, or applesauce. If you were really unlucky, the D unit can only contained a couple of pieces of white bread. That was a bad day, Jack. The Army also gave us an accessory pack with each meal, which included a spoon, salt, pepper, sugar, instant coffee, a couple of pieces of chewing gum, and toilet paper, as well as a 4-pack of cigarettes and book of 20 matches. I started smoking cigarettes in high school. I have since quit, but I'll tell you more about that later. So I was happy to find them in my accessory pack. Eventually, the U.S. military figured out smoking wasn't healthy for its troops, so the Army took cigarettes out of MCIs in 1975. I'll be honest, I was not a happy camper at the time. Hey, Army food wasn't exactly Miss K's cooking or fine dining, but you could survive on it, and it was better than going hungry. Of course, I never would have survived 12 months in Vietnam without Mama sending me care packages from home. In one of the first boxes, she mailed me a pair of work boots. There was a Tupperware iced tea cup and a couple of cans of jalapeno peppers in one boot and a couple of cans of Spam and beans and wieners in the other boot. I had a small electric cooktop in my hotel room in downtown Khon Thai, so I cooked myself late-night meals whenever I was hungry. Shortly after Mama sent me the jalapeno peppers, one of my buddies came into my room. Of course, he'd been drinking whiskey all night and was three sheets to the wind. Oh, man, he said. What you cooking, Robertson? Hey, get you some of the pork and beans and Spam, I told him, but you don't want any of these peppers. I love hot peppers, he said. Give me a couple of them. You don't want any of these, I said. These are from Louisiana. They get jalapeno in your business. He grabbed a couple of peppers anyway. A few seconds later, he ran out of my room looking for water. Somehow, Mama's iced teacup stayed with me all the way through Vietnam, and I've carried it with me in my back pocket ever since. I guess if it can make it through the napalm, mustard gas, and rice wine of Vietnam, I'll probably take it to my grave. Everywhere I go, I carry a gallon of iced tea in my light blue Tupperware cup. Now my cup even has its own Facebook page and Twitter account. Some people might even say my cup has a better personality than my nephew, Jace. Now, there are plenty of duplicates of my blue Tupperware cup, but there's only one original. It never leaves my sight. One time, a guy handed me a blank check and wanted to buy my iced tea cup. "Fill in the amount," he said. "Whatever it takes, I want that Tupperware cup." "It's not for sale," I told him. I told the guy to go buy his own Tupperware cup, but he insisted he wanted mine. I told him A&E TV wouldn't let me part with it. During our first season of Duck Dynasty, I walked into the Duck Commander warehouse, and one of the workers told me there was a big box for me in the back. "Are you sure it's for me?" I asked him. "Oh, yeah, it says Cy Robertson on it," he said. "Hey, put it on the back of the truck," I said. I took the box home and opened it up. Inside there was a stainless steel saucepan with a lid, a big boiling pot, and a really nice set of steak knives. I looked at the bottom of the box, and there were 12 Tupperware cups. There was also a letter to me from the chairman and CEO of the Tupperware Brands Corporation in Orlando, Florida. Apparently, Tupperware cups are making a comeback, and they have the lovely Merritt Robertson to thank.
Today with computers, if you're dating some little old girl online, you can't even smell her. Girls smell nice.
Chapter 20. The Woman of My Dreams. After I left Vietnam on October 17, 1969, the Army transferred me to Fort Devens in Shirley, Massachusetts, which is about 55 miles northwest of Boston. I was stationed at Fort Devens for about 2 years and worked in medical supply. Hey, you want to talk about living in a foreign land? I grew up in the South, and it took me a long time to get used to living in the cold, harsh winters of the Northeast. I'd rarely seen snow in my life, and it seemed like it snowed at Fort Devens 8 months out of the year. Hey, have you ever listened to someone from Boston talk? It sounds like their elementary school teachers went straight from Q to S when teaching them the alphabet. They don't know how to use the letter R. During a weekend pass, I visited Boston with a buddy of mine who was from there. He didn't have a car, so I drove mine. After we visited his parents, he took me to nearby Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is the home of Harvard University. He wanted me to go bar hopping with him to find some college girls. Hey, I figured the Ivy League and I went together like shrimp and grits. I dropped him off outside a bar and he told me, "Park the car at Harvard Yard." Of course, I had no idea what he said, so I drove around in circles for hours. And some people think I talk funny. People from Boston also use words I'd never heard before. Hey, they refer to shorts as clam diggers and headaches as bangers. They even refer to rubber bands as elastics. Do they use rubber bands to keep up their trousers? I walked into the barbershop on base, and the barber told me he was going to give me a whiffle. "Are we playing baseball?" I asked him. The first time I walked into my barrack, I asked a sergeant where I could find some water to drink. "The bubbler is down the hall," he said. "The what?" I asked him. It took me a few minutes to realize he was talking about a water fountain. Living in the Northeast was definitely a change in scenery for me, but I believe God has a purpose for everything. It didn't take me long to realize he'd sent me to Fort Devens to meet the woman who would become my wife. I met the former Christine Rainey for the first time when I was hitchhiking to an off-base nightclub in November 1969. Christine was riding in the car with two of her friends, one of whom I already knew, and they saw me walking down the road. They couldn't have missed me. I was wearing a black leather jacket with a big dragon on the back of it. The dragon practically glowed in the dark. I'd picked the jacket up in Vietnam. If Christine's friend hadn't recognized me, they probably would have thought I was some rock star. From the start, Christine didn't like me very much. She thought I was arrogant and full of myself. She even told me, "You think you're the rooster of the walk." Christine had been married once before. Her husband left her because they didn't think she could bear children. They'd tried to have a baby for a couple of years, but she couldn't get pregnant. Doctors told her she couldn't have children because of an underlying medical condition. Her husband wanted a family, so he left her. When Christine met me, she was still pretty leery about dating men. My buddy had been trying to set her up with some of his friends for months, but she had a long list of demands she wanted in her next boyfriend. "Well, describe to me the kind of man you want," my buddy told her. "Okay, here you go," she said. "He has to be 6 feet to 6 feet 3 inches tall with a slender frame. He has to have blue or green eyes and a beautiful smile with dimples. Most importantly, he also has to be smart and have a keen sense of humor and a warm heart." "I've got just the person for you," he told her. "There's no way you know anyone with all of those attributes," she said. "Hey, Christine Rainey didn't know the real Silas Merritt Robertson. I was 8 for 8, Jack." My buddy set us up on a blind date. Well, at least he was blind going into the date. I knew who I was taking out, but my buddy didn't tell her she was going out with me. He knew how she felt about me after they picked me up hitchhiking. I decided to take Christine to our company's Christmas party at Fort Devens on December 12, 1969. She picked my buddy and me up at our barracks. As soon as Christine saw me, she was convinced it was going to be the worst night of her life. She couldn't remember my name, but she remembered my face. How could anyone forget a face like mine? Of course, I turned on my charm and we had a great time. Christine said she'd never laughed so hard in her life. I amazed her with my dancing skills, of course, and we started dating regularly pretty soon thereafter. Christine was born and raised in Kentucky, where her father was a farmer. She loved living in Massachusetts. She'd moved there when she was 21 and was working as a seamstress in a factory that made furniture upholstery. After a couple of years of dating, I was ready to pop the big question. I knew she was the one. My enlistment in the Army was about to expire, and I knew I was moving back to Louisiana. I wanted to take Christine with me. Before I proposed to Christine, I called Mama to tell her the news. I knew Mama and Daddy wouldn't be happy that Christine had been married before. My family didn't believe in divorce. We believed that when you made a vow of marriage, you were supposed to spend the rest of your life with your spouse. I was taught that when you choose a husband or wife, you were making a commitment for the rest of your life. But it wasn't Christine's decision for her first marriage to end. "Hey, I've got a little news," I told Mama. "I'm fixing to get married. Her name is Christine. She was married before, so I want to make sure you will accept her as your daughter-in-law." There was a short pause on the other end of the telephone. I was getting a little anxious. "Yes, I'll accept her," Mama said. "Good," I said. "This is the woman I'm going to marry. If you can't accept her, I'm not going to be around either." "You ought to know better than that," Mama said. "I will accept her." On April Fool's Day, 1971, I told Christine's best friend that I was going to ask her to marry me. Of course, I was only kidding at the time. 5 days later, on the same day I was released from the Army, I asked Christine to marry me. Much to my surprise, she told me no. And then she told me no again. And again, and again, and again. Christine didn't want to marry me because she knew she couldn't have children. "I can't be your broodmare," she said. "Hey, I'm not like your first husband," I told her. "There are other doctors out there. If God wants us to have children, we'll have children. If he doesn't want us to have children, we'll adopt some kids. I want to marry you." Finally, after I'd pestered Christine for nearly a full day, she agreed to marry me. We went to see the Justice of the Peace the next day. On April 7th, 1971, we were married at the courthouse. Because I was leaving the Army, the judge even waived the state's requirement of having a 5-day waiting period, marriage license, and blood test before a couple could be married. When we were standing in front of the judge, he said to me, "Son, you just got out of a 3-year commitment. Are you sure you want another one?" "Yes, sir," I told him. I knew this commitment was for the rest of my life. Christine and I exchanged our vows and became husband and wife.
There's some people who got it and some people don't. Hey, I've always had it.
Chapter 21, Newlyweds. As soon as Christine and I were married, we jumped into my 1966 Plymouth Fury and drove straight to her parents' home in Kentucky. We were headed to Louisiana, but we stopped there so her parents could meet me. On the way to the courthouse the morning we were married, Christine said I wouldn't stop talking. But she said I barely said a word during the drive from Massachusetts to Kentucky. I guess I was in shock from actually going through with marriage. We arrived at her parents' home late at night, and I didn't meet them until the next morning.